All right, we are continuing our study of the book of Genesis, and we've been, for those of you who are visiting with us, we are in the period of time that Jacob is away from the promised land, and we've been looking at it kind of more topically than straight through the text. And we had a class where we talked about Jacob and his relationship with his wives, and then we talked about the relationship Jacob had with Laban and the key scenes that focus on that. And today we're going to look at it in terms of the bookends of the story of Jacob in Haran, or Paddan Aram, depending on if you're talking about the, well, whichever way you talk about it. The Bible talks about it both ways. The beginning of it is with a scene between Jacob and God, and the end of it is a scene with Jacob and God. And this, like I say, it frames the entire narrative of the time that Jacob is away, and I think it's helpful to look at these two scenes together. There are certainly some things that I think you're intended to see them as bookends to the scene, this part of the narrative, and I'll come back and point those out specifically a little bit later on. But as you remember, going all the way back to the beginning, Jacob has just deceived his father into blessing him. Esau is especially angry about this. Rebekah comes up with the plan to get Isaac to send Jacob away to his safety and think that it's his own idea. And so he is sent away. And as he is leaving and heading back all by himself, you find him doing a little bit of a reverse journey of Abraham. Abraham started over there and worked his way back, and came to the promised land, and now Jacob is kind of undoing that, going back over there. And he'll make his way back, of course, as well. But he stops at a certain place at night, and we're down in chapter 28 and verses 10 and following. And he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth. The top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I shall give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south. And in you and in your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. And we'll stop there and talk about some of the key things of this part of the story. Jacob, of course, is on his way. And as you frame this, you know, I said it's kind of the reverse of Abraham. But Abraham, he's going into the unknown, and Jacob is to some degree as well. But from our perspective, especially the way we've been looking at it, and we've kind of, you know, chopped it up into sections, we've got a pretty good idea of what's behind him and what is ahead of him. And he just knows what's behind him, of course. What he's running from is his brother, who is so angry that he wants to kill him. And this doesn't seem to be just, you know, hyperbolic rage. He's saying he's that angry. I'm so angry, I'm going to kill you, but he doesn't actually mean it. I mean, he is planning, as soon as Isaac is dead, I am going to kill my brother. And everybody's taking it seriously, and so he is getting out as fast as he can. But what he doesn't know, that ahead of him is Laban, who is going to be just as bad to him, in essence, as he was to his brother. Of course, we've talked about the fact that the things that Jacob received from his brother, he had every right to. I don't know that he should have gone about getting them the way he did. I certainly know that God did not need him to do it that way in order to accomplish his purposes. But God had promised him the blessing. The way that he went about doing it is what was so problematic of deceiving and lying, deceiving and lying, and all of those kinds of things. And this is exactly what Laban is going to turn around and do to him. He's going to do the sibling swap that Jacob had done with the blessing, and he's going to lie to him, and he's going to mistreat him, and cheat him and change his wages and everything else. And so he's in a bad spot, and he doesn't know just how bad it's going to be yet. And he has this dream, and in his dream, there's this ladder up to heaven. Most translations render it. It's hard to know exactly what it would have been. Some suggest that the word may be better rendered staircase or something along those lines. Think of the stepped slopes of a ziggurat, a Mesopotamian, temple to the gods. And the idea of the gate of heaven is ziggurat language as well in the ancient world, and that's how this ends. So it may have been something like that, but the reality is, if we get hung up on figuring out exactly what the mechanism was, we've kind of missed the point. Because if we're getting really worked up about, is it a ladder, or is it stairs, or is it like an escalator, or what exactly is it, we're missing the point, which is that angels are in communion with earth. God is in communion with earth. If we're going to get technical about it, the question we need to ask is, why do they need anything in order to get down here? And again, that's sort of not the point, is the means by which they travel. So don't get too hung up on that kind of thing. You may have a footnote in your Bible that says something along those lines. Again, that's not the point. The point is that this is the symbol of uninterrupted communion between heaven on earth. That God is ruling on the earth, and he is working out his purposes on the earth, and he is sending his messengers and his ministers, his servants, to do his will on the earth. And we need not forget that the Bible constantly emphasizes the fact that there is angelic work going on the earth, whether or not we can see it. I mean, here is the clearest place where you see this communion between heaven and earth through the work of the angels. But this is kind of what stands behind the opening scenes of the book of Job, too, if you stop and you think about it. The sons of God have come in to present themselves before God. Where have you been? And going to and fro on the earth is what Satan says. What do you think the rest of the angels had been doing, though? Probably something similar, doing God's work on the earth like you see them doing here. You find a similar picture in Zechariah. Daniel prays, and the angel is coming to give him the message, but he gets delayed in a spiritual battle with a different angel, and the archangel comes and bails him out. All of this is going on behind the scenes. Let us not forget of the spiritual realities going on behind what we cannot see. But then what's really striking about this image, this is kind of like the serpent that Tom was talking about, that Jesus picks up on the language and uses it to make a deeper point. He will say the same thing, or do the same thing regarding this. This is the scene with Nathanael in John chapter 1, where Nathanael's like, Nazareth, yeah, right, what's so special about that? And Jesus is like, oh yeah, I saw you under the fig tree. Oh, you're amazing, you're the Son of God. You think that's amazing, that I saw you before I could see you, I knew you before I could know you. Just wait, you'll see the heavens open and the angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man. He's picking up on this language from this dream and saying, I am the conduit between heaven and earth. And so he ultimately becomes that. Now, the other thing that's interesting about this, I picked this up from I want to say it was Bruce Waltke's commentary on Genesis, and he is, when he says something about the Hebrew, I tend to listen. Of course, anybody could be wrong about things, but he's written Hebrew grammars, so he knows a little bit more than just the average sort of person. He says literally that it was not set up on the earth, but it was placed toward the earth. And that's one of those things that could just be an idiom, which means set up on the earth. Or it could intend to make the point that it starts in heaven and goes down. And if that is a point that the author's trying to make, you can think about the theological significance of that. Where is the point of initiation? It's not on the earth going up, it's in heaven coming down. And if that's the idea, that certainly is consistent with everything else the Bible talks about when it talks about our relationship with God. Who initiates our relationship with God? Is it us or him? I mean, obviously it's him. He is the one who has reached down to us and offered us a hope of salvation. And I mean, aside from that, you just think about it logically. In the condition of sin that we are in, what could we possibly do on our own to initiate contact with God? We could beg and plead and do whatever we want, you know, be like the pagans jumping up and down and cutting ourselves and calling out on his name. But if he doesn't decide he wants to listen to us, we're completely hopeless. And so the idea that it begins in heaven and reaches down to the earth, whether or not that's a main point the author here is trying to make, it certainly is consistent with the idea that communion between heaven and earth is initiated by God, and that larger message of the Bible would fit with this as well. The real content of this dream, this vision that he has, is the renewal of the promise. This time to Jacob. And Jacob had not had any, as far as we know, he's not had any sort of revelation from God as his father and his grandfather had before. He may have heard, I think probably he had heard from his mother what God had intended for him. It's hard to imagine Rebecca not telling Jacob about this kind of thing, especially when, you know, Jacob's the favorite for her and Esau's the favorite. You can just imagine her saying, well, yeah, your dad might like Esau, but you know what God told me about you. You can imagine in a family with, you know, communication as broken as this family seems to be, that sort of conversation happening along the way. But the promise comes to Jacob by Isaac in this chapter of deceit, but now it's coming to Jacob by means of God. It's interesting that in chapter 27, Isaac does not specify the blessing of the offspring. You remember the three main parts of the promise, the land, nation, and seed, land, nation, offspring. When Isaac is giving this blessing to Jacob in chapter 27, he mentions the land, he mentions the nation. But he does not talk about the offspring. Now, it's possible, back up in verse 4 of chapter 28, Isaac is again saying some stuff to Jacob before he goes. May he give you the blessing of Abraham. That may be an all-encompassing sort of idea that would include it. But even then, it's not specified as it will be here. And God comes down and then gives the full promise to Jacob as he had to Abraham and Isaac as well. And one of the things that's interesting about this, and again, I always hesitate because I don't know how much I'm reading into something that's not there. And so take it for what it's worth. But when he says, I am the Lord, this is verse 13, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. I mean, what you're used to is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? And of course, that's after the time of Jacob that becomes the very common phrase. But it's not, I am the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac, and I am your God too, or I will be your God too. Are we supposed to make something of that blank that is there? Is it just because it's early in the story and we shouldn't think about it that much? Or is there an open question here? I am the God of Abraham and I am the God of Isaac. Will I be your God too, Jacob? And putting some of the impetus on the relationship back on Jacob at that point. I am making my promises known to you. How are you going to respond? At least plausibly, there's something to think about there. Again, how far do you push it from a gap in the text where you might expect something? That's where it becomes a little bit iffier. So, again, take it for what it's worth, but it's worth thinking about, at least, I think. Greg? Sure. Yeah, we'll come to that. Fundamentally, how well does he know Jacob's heart? And of course, you know, he's God. So that kind of answers itself, I think. And we're going to see Jacob is one who kind of struggles his way to a relationship with God. I mean, quite literally, we're going to see him struggling his way to his relationship with God later. This afternoon, even. Now, that if-then language, let me just hang tight on that. We'll come to that in a few moments. I don't know if it's a question of whether God will do it or not. It's kind of standard covenant sort of language. So, I am with you. I'll keep you wherever you go, God goes on to say. And this, of course, in the context of him running from home. And again, you think of this in the cultural context of paganism where gods were thought to be localized. You know, Babylon had their gods and Canaan had their gods and, you know, Assyria would have their gods later on and so forth and so on. And your gods were most powerful in the region that they were gods. And very often they were thought to only have power there. And so if, you know, a nation went to war with another nation and they fought on the other nation's home turf, the home team, so to speak, their gods would have the advantage. I mean, this is kind of how they thought about things. Because our God's power only goes so far. Well, God is saying, I'm going wherever I want to go. I'm not limited to here. I'm not limited. You know, I can be Isaac's God and I can be your God in two different places at the exact same time. And this is, again, it's a novel concept in the ancient world that a God was not localized, that he wasn't restricted geographically in his power. And you find this kind of message constantly in the Old Testament, the fact that God is not restricted. I mean, that's, I think, one of the, at least one of the points of the vision in Ezekiel, the very beginning of God's ability to go wherever, and it doesn't matter if you're in Babylon or you're in Jerusalem, God is your God and God is protecting you if you are one of His people. And so this, I think, is a piece of this as well, that God will be going with him. And this is then probably part of why, you remember last time when we were talking about his relationship with Laban, and he had this incredible confidence that God has taken away Laban's flocks and given them to me. Why could he have this confidence that God would be with him through all of this, that God had actively done this? Well, part of it is because, as we said last time, as Laban continued to change the wages, he changed them to a point of specificity that nobody could have done anything with in terms of making it all happen on their own. So he knew there was a higher power, but beyond that, he knew it because God said, I will be with you in Haran. And I will protect you, and I will go with you, and those kinds of things. And so this is a piece of why Jacob interprets events the way he does later on. I'll bring you back to this land, which means at the outset, Jacob knows he's not going to stay over there. And he thinks already he's not going to stay. It's one of these interesting things when you look at this dream. It changes Jacob's perspective. He's still going for the same reason. He's still going to do the same basic things. But his entire trip is reoriented as a result of this. Yeah, I'm going over there and yeah, I'm coming back. But now I'm going and God is going with me and God is going to bring me back. And so again, when God says, it's time to go home, Jacob, that is something that is going to be impactful to him and say, okay, then it's time for us to go back. Now, Jacob's response upon waking up is interesting, and again, it's subject to interpretation. The Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. Is this hyperbole? God is even closer than I realized. You know, some commentators will look at this and say, well, of course, Jacob knew that he was there. How could he be so ignorant of God as to not know that he was there? And this is some sort of exaggeration to say that, you know, God is even closer than I realized. Or it could well be that Jacob is not as well-versed in theology as we might like to think he is. And you ask him later on in his life, and he would say, well, yeah, of course I knew God was there, or I know now that God is here, but then I was still starting to learn things. And I don't know, you know, we've talked about Jacob as a person, a very complex person who grows in his faith over time. However we interpret this phrase, I did not know it exactly, I do think that this is something of a major turning point in Jacob's life, spiritually speaking. He's going to have other turning points as well, including the scene at the end of his time away from the Promised Land, as we'll talk about in just a little while. But this is one of the first key points, his first encounter with God. And again, you can't, you know, How can you imagine this wouldn't be a key turning point in his life, to have your very first encounter with God? And so if you interpret it in that sense that you could say that he is, in some sense, learning the omnipresence of God, really for the first time. That God can be with him, God will be with him, and so forth. Yeah, Brent?
Couldn't it just be that he felt, like, obviously they don't have the temple at this time, but, like, God is at the temple in a different way than he is at other places. Mm-hmm. And so it couldn't just be that he felt that God was present here in a different way than he usually is?
Yeah, and it could be that. I mean, it could be God is here in general, but God is really here in a different kind of sense, as has been manifest by this vision, versus some sort of exaggeration or learning. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, there's a variety of ways of understanding this. And, you know, it'd be nice if Jacob had said, the Lord is in this place and I did not know it. And by that I mean, but you don't have that kind of specific clarification as to what exactly he's getting at. So, again, this is one of those phrases where I think it's good intellectual exercise to think about it, to think about all the things that it could mean, to try to find some value in thinking about that, even spiritually, but it's hard to be dogmatic in this sort of thing. Gregory, were you going to say something?
I was just wondering, in terms of this theology, and thinking, trying to sort of touch on this, this is a God versus the God, and he's learning. I mean, are we seeing him grow?
That's a possibility as well. How much does he understand about God at the beginning? You know, has he come to, you know, does he share his father's full faith at this point? And again, we can't know for certain. Does he think God is, you know, limited? If he's Isaac's God and Isaac's back there, how can he be with me too? Again, we just can't possibly know what he would have known or thought. So, like I say, it's worth thinking through it. It's a great place. I was talking to one of my classes last week about this. It's a great place on something like this where, you know, nothing in your salvation hangs in the balance in terms of, you know, what Jacob was thinking. That doesn't impact you that much. You can read this three or four different ways, and any one of them is a legitimate interpretation of what he might have meant. And so it's helpful sometimes to kind of stop in these places and think through the options and go through the exercise of interpretation, just so you can, you know, if nothing else, well, this one's better than this one because, and then that can help you with more important texts as they arise. Yeah, Hayden?
So in talking about, like, the fact that we know that angels were, you know, consistently doing things throughout the course of the Bible, throughout the course of, you know, human history, and then in talking about the fact that there are other gods in other lands and people are not literal gods, but...
Right. I think, at the very least, you get the idea in some places that fallen angels, demons, were behind some of what's going on in idolatry. You know, what exactly is happening with, you know, Pharaoh's magicians doing the same tricks that Aaron is doing, but to a lesser degree. I mean, that's been interpreted in a variety of ways as well, but one of the possibilities is you've got the powers of Satan behind those magicians, and God's still showing that he's more powerful, and, you know, yeah, you turn yours into a snake, and mine will eat that one and solve that problem. But certainly the idea of, you know, the text I mentioned in Daniel a moment ago, the prince of Persia withstanding the angel of God, obviously that's no human prince. This is spiritual battle. There is a demonic force that is standing behind the nation of Persia. And God's angels who are behind, you know, Michael, the chief angel of your people. The angel of God behind Israel is doing battle with the angel of Persia. What exactly does that mean? What does that look like? Who knows? But, you know, the reality of spiritual forces may well have been behind some of the perceived reality of idolatry. How far do we press that? How specific do we get with that? That's where I get a little bit more hesitant. But I do get the impression, and I'm completely, other than the Daniel passage, I'm completely blanking on specific texts that make that kind of reference. But there are some that lead you to think that. That's a good question, though. Brent, were you going to say something else? Okay. Tom, you want to add anything there? You want to stay away from that too? All right. Jacob, in response to this, makes this vow down in verse 20. If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. And the stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. And so we were talking earlier about this kind of reorienting Jacob's journey. This if-then language is standard covenant language. He's not placing conditions on his obedience. He's not saying, well, God, if you do this, then I'll worship you. That's not what's going on. It's like I say, it's standard covenant language, the way covenants are formed. Jacob is entering this relationship with God, and it's a way of giving, you know, God has said he'll do this, and so I'm giving my assurance that I'll do this in response to God's keeping of his part of this covenant. The one other thing that I'll mention here that I think is interesting to think about before we leave this scene, we'll take a couple comments and then leave this scene. Is Jacob setting up the stone as a pillar. This is the very, and obviously he's not setting this up in any sort of pagan ritual sort of thing, but this is one of the kinds of things that will later be forbidden by the law of Moses, this kind of setting up of stones as pillars. And it's a good reminder that these traditions that are coming from the book of Genesis, whether Moses wrote it all verbatim or whether there were stories that were passed down and Moses compiled it. I mean, again, we don't know the exact mechanism by which Genesis was written, other than God is behind it ultimately. But these are very ancient traditions because somebody writing, and again, the liberal theories that Moses didn't have anything to do with any of the Pentateuch, it was written much later on. This is the kind of thing they would have weeded out, if at all possible. This is violation of the law, and you've got the patriarch, you know, Israel himself doing this that is in violation of the law. Why aren't they cutting those sorts of stories out? You know, in just a little bit, he's going to go over there and marry a pair of sisters. That's against the law, too. The number of Levitical laws that the patriarchs break is a testament to how honest they are about the patriarchs. Because somebody later would have weeded all of that out and said, no, we can't have Jacob doing this if they're just making stuff up about him. So it speaks to the authenticity, the truth of the stories of these people.
I was wondering about the phrase, the if-then statement,
yeah.
If God will be with me, then the Lord shall be my God.
Yeah.
Is what is the common, like, I guess, way of thinking about your God being God, like, if he knew Yahweh at all, if he knew that, obviously, it seems like he recognizes that at least is the God that he's talking to. Is it just, oh, now I'm going to be, not going to adhere to the rules that God set in place, or is it saying, now I'm applying the covenant that applied to my dad to me, or what's the kind of mechanism in which, how does this change his relationship with this God?
It's hard to say because, again, we're not told all of the ins and outs of Jacob's relationship with God before this. It could be Jacob had never really paid much attention to anything about God, and now all of a sudden he's getting a revelation that's setting him straight. It could be that he's listened to every word his dad had to say, and his dad taught him well, and now he is making his faith his own, we might say. And it's coming to him in a very personal, direct way for the first time. Or it could be something completely different. Again, it's hard to pinpoint that sort of thing. At the very least, it is him receiving for the first time the promises to Abraham that are going on through this family forever, and him accepting the reality of that and making a vow on the basis of that. What does that mean about the before and after specifics? That's harder to say. Did I dodge that well enough?
Yeah.
You going to say something on that, Tom?
Same language you find in these covenant renewal ceremonies,
yeah,
like with Joshua and Israel. So you can already have a covenant and just restate the wording of it. I will be your God, you will be my people.
Okay.
So, again, what isn't clear here is Jacob done that earlier,
right,
or is this the first time?
Right. Charlie? Well, yeah, I mean, he just doesn't know what's going to happen. And we'll come back and talk about that scene probably next week specifically. When he hears that, you know, Esau's marching with an army to meet him, he's probably just unsure what exactly is going to happen. And so he's kind of, I don't want to say he's hedging his bets, but he's trying to let some people live as a result of it if worse comes to worse. But he just doesn't know what's going to happen. Does he remember these words then 20 years from now specifically? How would he have interpreted the piece specifically 20 years from now? I don't know. That's a good question. But yeah, we'll come back to that scene probably next week. Well, let's jump ahead then to the end of Jacob's time away, where we find his other encounter with God. This is right after he has split everything up into two parts, and he's, you know, sending gifts ahead of him to try to placate Esau even more. And he stays behind. The family, you know, fords the river. He stays behind. Very often it's presumed that he's going to pray and meditate. It's hard, again, to know exactly what's going on. Maybe it's pragmatism and making sure nothing had been left behind. But the same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and took everything else that he had. And Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. And then he said, "Let me go, for the day is broken." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, "For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered." The sun rose upon him as he passed Penuel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the people of Israel do not eat the sinew of the thigh that is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip on the sinew of the thigh. All right, let me kind of get through some stuff here, then we can try to talk some more and make some sense of this. But there are a few things that I want to get out, at least at the outset. First of all, who is this person that is fighting with Jacob? The text simply identifies him as a man who had wrestled with him. Jacob is going to come to understand that it is God. Jacob will say, "I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been spared." And so he understands that it is God. It's a fascinating thing if you do a history of interpretation on this. You know, what have the Jews said about this text as far as you can go back and all that. There's some fascinating stuff that's been suggested. A very recent, not especially recent now, but within the last 20 or 30 years, journal article I stumbled upon a while back suggested that it was Esau who snuck across the river and fought with Jacob. And the reason why is because he's going to meet Esau later, and he's going to say something like, "To see your face is like to see the face of God," and that's supposed to be the clue that it was really Esau all along. No, Jacob believes it's God, and Hosea will say it's an angel, angel is in poetic parallelism with God in the next line of Hosea 12, 3 and 4. And as we've talked about before, this angel of the Lord figure who shows up in the Old Testament is equated with God. He's not a normal angel. He is some sort of manifestation of God. And so that may be the same thing that Hosea is getting at as well. When you know this man says, "You've striven with God and man," has he striven with God only morally, or is that a discussion of this very fight as well? Well, what happened exactly in this fight? And this is one of those spots where, you know, you really get the idea of what's important, because the text doesn't answer the questions you might want it to answer. I mean, what I would like is a blow-by-blow discussion of the fight, because that'd be really, really interesting. And it's just, they fought, and he couldn't prevail, and he dislocated his hip. It's like, really? This could be like really exciting. I mean, what would the movie scene be like of this? But in reality, that's not important. What's important is the conversation. And the fight is just the preamble to the dialogue. The dialogue is what matters here. And ultimately, the dialogue is about the renaming of Jacob. That's what's going on here, is the change of Jacob from Jacob to Israel, which itself is a fascinating thing, and we'll talk about this more as the class goes on. But most people, when they get their name changed, their name is changed. You know, Abram becomes Abraham, and then he's Abraham. Sarai becomes Sarah, and then she's Sarah. Jacob becomes Israel, and then he's Jacob for a while, and he's Israel here and there. And he's Jacob again, and then he might be Israel. And there's one verse where he's both in the same verse, which I think may be instructive for us, but we'll come to that when we get there. But this renaming of Jacob doesn't quite stick the way the others do, which is an interesting thing to think about. We're not going to discuss that more today, but just bear it in mind. But what has happened is Jacob fights to a draw and clings for a blessing. It seems to be that ultimately he's beginning to realize who it is that he's fighting with. He admits his inferiority. He does so in two ways. One, because when someone says, "Give me your name," and he gives it immediately, and then he says, "What's your name?" The other guy goes, "Nope, not telling you my name." You see who the stronger one is there. The fact that he is asking for a blessing, again, is a way of admitting inferiority. The greater blesses the lesser, you may remember from the book of Hebrews. And in giving his name, there may be something of an admission of who he is. That his assailant is making him come face to face with his identity. That he's Jacob not just in name, but he's Jacob in character. Remember the one that grasps at the heel, the supplanter. This is who he has been in a very real degree, someone who's trying to make his own way. Trying to do his own thing. And while he has relied on God, more than some I think would give him credit for, he still is not quite where he needs to be. And again, God is making him recognize that, realize that, and say it's time for you to be somebody different at this point. His hip is thrown out of socket, and he's clinging for the blessing. But the name change comes in verse 28. You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. And again, that's another sign of his inferiority, that he's being renamed. For you have striven with God and man and have prevailed. And the question that I like to think about here is, how exactly does Jacob prevail against God? You've striven with God and man and have prevailed. And I think the implication is you prevailed in both. You know, he's prevailed over Esau. He's prevailed, in some sense, over Isaac. He's prevailed over Laban. How has he prevailed against God? Specifically in the context of this fight. I mean, at best, he has fought to a draw in terms of the fight. And then he is the one that is injured and limping for the rest of his life, or at least for a while. And he is the one that admits his inferiority. He is the one that gets his name changed. He is the one that is begging for a blessing. So how exactly did he win? What's that? Okay, so the withstanding of a test is something to think about here, Tom.
Well, I was going to say, you have the same problem with crucifixion. A God that you could put to death would be a bunch of a God.
Right.
And a God you could wrestle with and go toe-to-toe with and at least come to a draw, that wouldn't be much of a God
right.
either. And that's clearly not the message.
Yep.
God was restraining himself, and I think the idea of a test is probably a good way of looking at it. And Jacob didn't give up. So God was testing him with
a limit of
his, you know, what he was capable of.
Okay.
I think it was kind of his way of telling Jacob that he had done well by humbling himself.
Okay. So the humbling of himself before God, I think, is a key part of that as well. You know, how do you defeat God? Well, the reality is you don't defeat God. But what you can do is you make sure God can't defeat you. And that even sounds borderline blasphemous to say, right? You make sure God can't defeat you. But how can you make sure that God can't defeat you? You do so by submitting yourself to Him. And if you have submitted yourself to God and to God's will and to doing what God wants you to do, God will no longer defeat you. If you admit your dependence on Him, He will no longer defeat you. And so it's a reorienting again of Jacob from doing it his own way like a Jacob would to doing it God's way like an Israel would. And so I think this is a lot of the idea, at least. It is withstanding this test and doing all of this, but ultimately he submits himself to God. And he admits dependence on God. And you can't receive the blessing if you're fighting against God. It's when you stop fighting against him and you start laying hold and clinging and begging for a blessing and submission, that's when you're on God's side and God will no longer withstand you. And so it is when he is beaten in the fight, it's when he doesn't prevail that he is suddenly able to prevail. It's when he is beaten in the fight that he becomes bold in faith. And he seeks the blessing, which again is an admission of inferiority. And this is the way Jacob wins. It's winning by losing. It's the same sort of thing that we've been talking about all day, really, at this point. All right, thoughts about the fight? We've got a couple minutes left. I know there's a whole lot that I ran through really quickly. I want to kind of talk about the framing of this time away in just a second. But before I do that, Tom?
The reason that we're talking about Joel chapter 2, where Joel summons the people to battle with God because he's attacking them. But what it really is a summons to surrender to God.
Right.
And that's the way you're going to win this battle.
It's same idea again there. Yeah, hey. And then the really crazy thing is, not touching that. And then the crazy thing is, you get older and you realize they actually were right. Once you have your own kids, so it's not just that you admitted that they were right; they actually knew what they were talking about. It's crazy. All right, what else here? Anything else here? All right, like I said, there are some kind of bookends to the narrative on either side that frame this entire time away. There are three different pairs of things, and the last one is the one that I want to spend a little bit of time thinking about because it's the most interesting in terms of what's going on. You've got two angel sightings. This time begins with the latter vision, and it ends with the latter vision. There are the two angels scenes, one on either end of this time period. There are two divine visions and blessings, the dream of the latter and the wrestling with God here at the end as well. But the one that I find to be most interesting are the two time markers, because you don't find a whole lot of time markers in the Bible. And very often when you find one, it means more than just what time it is. You think of John 13, Judas goes out from the disciples, and he's going out to betray Jesus, and John says, and it was night. Is it just like a random occurrence that John says, oh, I think I should tell him it's nighttime right now? Or is in a gospel where there's light and darkness representing good and evil all the way through, Judas betrays Jesus and it was night, does it mean more than just it was night? And that's how I've come to read that. Well, it's noteworthy then that you've got two mentions of the sun in this. We read both of them, actually. I don't know if you caught them. As he is laying down to sleep back in chapter 28, the sun goes down. And as he is crossing the river the next morning after wrestling with God, the sun comes back up. And so, literally, the entire period of time away from the promised land is characterized as a period of darkness in this way, which is an interesting thing if that is, in fact, what the author's doing. And then the other one here with the sun rising, I think you've got something symbolic going on here as well. This is metaphorically a new day dawning for Jacob. He has fought with God all night. His name has changed. He has a blessing at the hand of God, and he is beginning his trip back to the promised land. Or he's getting close to concluding his trip back to the promised land, and the sun rose on him as he passed Penuel. I mean, that's the same sort of metaphor we even use sometimes. A new day has dawned for this person, and we don't mean just that the sun had come up. And that may well be what's going on here as well. And so this second one would kind of do double duty, closing the time away with the sun rising and then also marking a new day, so to speak, for Jacob with the sun rising. All right, I'm out of time. Any last thoughts before? Yes, ma'am.
It says he wrestled with God. It seems like he was wrestling with God
Yeah, I think I kind of said in passing at the beginning, a lot of commentators look at this as a period of prayer is how it begins. And some have interpreted the entire thing as a metaphor for prayer. I don't know if I'd go that far. I've never prayed so hard I limped afterwards. But maybe that's my problem, though. But the idea that there is introspection going on, at least at the beginning of this, and fighting with who he was to become who he's going to be. Yeah, I certainly think there's something going on there. All right, well, thank you for your attention and comments today.